In this episode of Galactic Chat, we talk with Deborah Biancotti, a writer based in Sydney. Her first collection, A Book of Endings, was shortlisted for the 2010 William L. Crawford Award for Best First Fantasy Book. Deborah can be found online at deborahbiancotti.net. Welcome, Deb, to Galactic Chat. How are you this evening?
I'm very well. Elisa, how are you?
Yes, I'm well, thank you. Yes.
Excellent. This is a great interview. Shall we stop there?
Now, unfortunately, people do want to hear about Deborah Biancotti and what you write and why.
Oh, bless.
Yeah, I know. So that's my very first question, actually. Why do you write?
Oh, God, so you're starting with the easy ones.
Yeah, I am, actually.
Why do I write? I don't know. I mean, as a little kid, it was just something I wanted to do.
Okay.
You know, when I was reading books, I wanted to write them. And when I was daydreaming, that was part of my grand success, was I just wanted to be a writer from an early age. And I don't think that I really, I mean, obviously I didn't have any understanding of what that meant, but it really was, I think, something I was just born with, you know, that and my attitude problem and various other features of myself. But now I write because I really enjoy it as a, you know, I think as an intellectual challenge, although that's probably a misleading sort of term. I mean, I just like really nutting out how to make this damn thing work. Mm-hmm. And that's usually my thought process as I'm doing it, just how do I make this damn thing work? And I think it's a real buzz. It's an excitement of actually achieving that. You know, it's like a fun park ride in a way. There's ups and downs, but you stay for the thrill. It's probably some bizarre sort of adrenaline junkiness I have that's completely maladaptive.
And so the thrill is the point where you've nutted it out?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's definitely the most satisfying part of it. But there's also that wonderful, you know, time in between where as you're writing, you're actually not aware of time and space and the words coming out. You're just completely focused on this sense of flow that you get out of it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's very little else that I do that makes me feel like it's addressing every single part of what I can offer. You know, day jobs don't kind of do it. Going to the gym doesn't kind of do it. But sitting there writing really feels like everything I've got I can actually bring to this immediate task.
Wow.
Yeah, it sounds kind of good, doesn't it?
Yeah, because now I want to go, well, what is it that you bring to the task? I mean, you said before that, you know, the intellectual challenge and you didn't want that to be misleading, but your work is highly intellectual. I mean, it's multi-layered and it's very, very clever. So is that planned or is that just you bringing everything to the task?
I can't say I plan to be clever, no. I think that must be just whatever I can bring to the task, yeah.
Okay. So do you set out with a very clear idea of where you want to go or do you set out with a problem that you want to solve? How do you approach?
I mean, where to start?
Yeah. I mean, we are mostly talking short stories, I guess.
I guess for short stories, the way I often start out is with a, you know, just an image or a line or something in my head. It's actually a very inauspicious beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll have this, like, for example, I wrote a story years ago, King of All and the Metal Sentinel.
Yes.
And the way that one occurred to me was the first paragraph appeared in my head as I was going to sleep.
Wow.
So I wrote that down, and then the next day I started building it into a story. So they actually, you know, you could probably argue that they come out of the subconscious or something and they've been percolating for a while. But by the time the idea reaches my conscious brain, it's really just an image or a line or a paragraph or the idea of a particular kind of character stuck in a particular situation.
Mm. And I guess that's probably, you know, a good segue into the kinds of things that you write about. I describe you as a humanist. And would that be kind of the way you see yourself?
I don't think you're the first one to give me that label either, actually. I think people have often called me a humanist, which is interesting. I mean, I don't know if I really understand what it means.
Well, I mean, because you're a very strong person and a very strong writer and your stories are strong and powerful. But you seem to really be fascinated with the character that you're writing about, whether we're looking at them or we're looking with their eyes, you seem to be really intrigued by people.
Hmm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I often tell people that, you know, at university I studied English literature and psychology. And it was because I felt that you needed to have an understanding of prose and people to really survive in the world, not even to succeed, but just to get by. I think people are definitely the most fascinating thing we have on the planet. I mean, they're the best and worst of everything that we can offer, I think, is our humanity. And I think that's really a fascinating topic.
Because you're not judgmental, that's the other thing. You quite happily will, with such a even-handedness, present a completely corrupted person or a completely flawed person without judgment. You're more interested, I think, in how that person is, not even necessarily how they came to be that person. Do I have to back that up with an example?
Yeah, go for it.
No, I don't know.
I mean, that's true. I think that, you know, I'm very, as a human being, I'm very judgmental. So I'm very pleased to hear that I'm not judgmental in my stories. Or maybe I've just got a really warped sort of judgment scale. But I think you can get some really fascinating results out of people who aren't necessarily what we would call the good people. Mm-hmm. And I actually think, although I hate to jump into religion so early, but I was raised in a family, 50% of whom were quite religious. And I always found that they were not necessarily the best people in the family, and they were not necessarily setting the best example or achieving the best results. But they were certainly trying, you know, and they were probably articulating their attempts harder than anyone else. And I think that gives you a sense growing up when you see, you know, what's meant to be the good and how that doesn't necessarily do good. It gives you a really complicated idea, I think, of human beings. Did that answer it? Or do you need now to jump to your example?
I was looking through your body of work because, you know, I am reasonably familiar with it.
Oh, yeah. Because we did this little thing a couple of years ago. You might not remember.
And I can't for the life of me really find a very good example, because I think now, well, because I guess when we'll talk more about your upcoming work, that those are obviously not the best people in society, and maybe that's what I've got. Maybe the first and final game, for example.
That's true, and I do have a particular love for sort of the vengeance tale. You know, the very idea of an avenger is someone who's willing to do bad for good, theoretically. But guys, they're doing bad, you know, and if we're judging someone on their actions, then that would make them surely a bad person. But the most fascinating characters, like, you know, The Equalizer back in the 70s and John Luther in the new Luther series coming out of the UK, they're actually, you know, they're not great people. But they're doing a lot of bad and good in their attempts to be a good person. And I find that sort of failed attempt to be a good person really, really interesting, because I think that's where most people live. I think we are mostly trying to do good and be good people, but, gee, we screw up a lot of the time.
Because that's the complexity of life, which is that there are too many variables going on at any one point in time to properly satisfy all of them. But I was just about to say, coming back to A Book of Endings, which we should probably talk about. I would love to talk about the process of how we made this lovely book. But
well, we were trying to be good people and we did some good and bad things.
Shh, we're not supposed to laugh at that. Yeah, I mean, I guess Hush, for example, is a very good example of that, where, you know, you start out with good intentions, but there are always consequences. Oh, that's what I was going to say, that we called the collection A Book of Endings, which was because you had said that you had a lot of criticism that your stories don't have endings or are only endings. Was that...
Yeah, I had a lot of people telling me my endings actually could be quite opaque, I think is a polite way to say it. So the endings weren't necessarily satisfying in a lot of my stories. So quite perversely, I decided to call the whole book a book of endings, so that, you know, to bring the endings to the forefront so everyone could look at them and say, I wouldn't have picked that ending. It was probably not a great idea, but, you know, we went with it.
Because I disagree, I guess, that your stories don't have endings, and I guess what they actually have is what you are encapsulating is a moment in time, and moments in time don't have endings. So, like, for example, Diamond Shell, though, where, you know, oh, am I going to spoil it for people who haven't read it yet? You know, it's just like, I'm just going to disappear off into the ether. That's that.
Yeah.
No explanation, no wanting anybody to understand. Things just are.
Yeah, and one of my favourite endings, I think, of my own stories would be The Distance Keeper, which ends with maybe the world exploding or maybe not. And that was a direct result of some criticism I'd had about, I can't remember which story now, about how, I'm not sure what happens in the ending. So I thought, well, if you're not sure what happens in the ending, I'm going to give you a story that damn well doesn't have an ending and you can work that one out. So, yes, more of my perversity.
Yeah, I hated that story.
Oh, I like The Distance Keeper.
I just didn't like the ending.
it's a great idea, actually, that there's going to be some second book called A Book of Beginnings, and it will just be the next chapter after all of the endings of all of those 21 stories. We'll just be 21 beginnings. What happened next?
Yeah, but see, I mean, okay, for example, your 2012 story, which was, you know, isn't it obvious, though? I mean, I don't know, maybe. See, this is my question, is do you think that kind of criticism is asking you to do the work for the reader?
Well, certainly I felt that at the time. I might, you know, looking back, I might feel a bit more generous about it. But I guess for me, really what the endings of the story signify is probably the ending of a life, if we're going to be really symbolic about it. Because, you know, as a non-believer, I have no particular idea what happens when you die. I'm not convinced of any particular thing. And so I feel like my stories actually have that kind of sense of, well, holy crap, what's happening next?
Or nothing happens next.
Yeah, well, maybe nothing happens. In some of them, nothing happens. And in some of them, you're just sort of thrown into the void, you know. I'm sure I've done a happy ending here and there, but not off the top of my head.
See, I think that you're supposed to argue that The King and the Meta Sentinel is your happy ending, but I just think that's the saddest story.
See, the thing I love about that story, though, is it really does show two quite damaged beings making the best of what they've got left.
Yeah.
And I think that's a powerful theme for me very much.
And I think that's a theme that is ongoing in your work.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think that theme's leaving anytime soon.
No, although getting darker and more with the bad endings.
Oh, I don't know. My new stuff, I think, eventually has a happy ending.
So, your very first short story that you had published was The First and Final Game, and you won an Aurealis Award for that.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you go when the very first thing you publish is considered to be the best horror story of the year, you know, in the Australian scene?
Yeah, so I had several people convincing me that the only way you go from there is down.
Right.
Yes, and then I did have a very well-meaning friend who's trying to convince me, holy crap, you need to capitalise on this prestigious award by writing a novel right now.
Mm-hmm.
So neither of those things particularly happened. So I think you just kind of put your head down and grit your teeth and just do what you have to do to get through that kind of attention, because people are quite excited and you know, have various other emotional reactions to that kind of early success.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's almost something like, you know, at that point it's probably not as useful to you as you think it's going to be before you're published. So you just get through it.
So it's not some great validation that, oh, I want to be a writer and I can be one, or success awaits me.
Yes, that's right. No, it wasn't for me at the time. I mean, being published was. But winning the award was just sort of a crazy thing that I never really anticipated. I mean, I think they were, you know, the Aurealis Awards were being given out in Melbourne back then, and it was some quiet little sort of gathering in Justin Ackroyd's bookstore, I think, from memory. And I didn't even remember which night they were on. Like, it's not like now where you've got big parties and everyone gets rolling drunk and and people flying to state. So I had completely forgotten that the awards were on until I got a phone call the next day that congratulating me. So it was nice for a day, but because it wasn't something I was anticipating anyway, it was a bit like the Crawford Award. You know, the Crawford Award came along for A Book of Endings, and it was just such an unanticipated piece of recognition that at first you sort of go, oh, that's nice, I guess. That seems quite nice. Mm. I wasn't expecting that. That's lovely.
Yeah.
And it's like an unexpected gift, and then you kind of put it on the mantelpiece and think, oh, I don't know what I do with that now. It's awesome, though.
It's more heartwarming.
It's good at the time, but it actually doesn't. It doesn't have a prolonged sense of satisfaction. Well, it didn't for me at that time. It's interesting the way you don't get the awards or the recognition that you thought you were going to get or that you were looking for. You know, and none of it turns out to be as life changing as you thought it was going to be looking for it at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, when you think you've got that perfect frock and you put it on and you go, but I still look like me. How did this happen?
Oh, but it's not the perfect frock.
Well.
Now, I think that's really interesting because I guess when we sat down, I mean, I would like to talk about how we made A Book of Endings because I think it was the first collection I've done. It's the only long collection I've done.
Because we're never doing another one that long. Sorry, are we still taping? Or is it...
Yes, it's 21 short stories, and we both agree now it should have been 18.
Yes.
But that's because it's 20 grams too heavy for postage.
Yeah, that's right. It wasn't an aesthetic decision in the end. It was a weight decision, I think, we made.
Now, my postmaster wanted me to make it much lighter. But, because you weren't really into the idea of being collected in the first place.
No.
And I think that's funny because then when we sat down and had a look, we worked out you'd won an award for your short story writing every year since you started writing.
Nominated, yeah.
Nominated.
Not won. Yeah, I don't want to take away from the winners. But, yeah, I remember that time, actually, that I think you worked it out and said, do you realise you've been in every Dittmer or Aurealis list ever since you started publishing? That was kind of funny because I hadn't realised that at all. So was there a question in that? Should I be answering a question?
Just that you didn't... so you hadn't realised that, but you also... And I don't know, this is a feminist probing type question, that you never really thought about that as some kind of indication of the body of work you were compiling?
I think there were much fewer collections then. Only a handful of people I knew had collections out. And I didn't actually feel like I had a body of work at that point. Because, you know, I mean, the standard wisdom about me was that I was not a prolific writer. So, you know, even though I'd had like one story published a year for 9 years or something, it didn't feel like a lot. And in fact, recently when I was chatting to a friend who's just finished her novel after 9 years,
wow.
She called me prolific. Yeah, she called me prolific and I laughed. And then I realised, of course, in her book, that is prolific, nine stories or 21 stories. When she's been writing one novel that whole time.
Yeah, I mean, you're not prolific. You're not somebody that I would say, quick, I need 4 short stories by the end of this year.
Mm.
And I wonder if that's because you write very precisely and very, I want to say carefully, but it's, you know, for you, is it, you know, it's got to be, is it that you don't have enough time to write? Is it that you redraft many times? Is it that you want to get it down perfectly the first time? I mean, 21 short stories is a lot.
Sure, that's enough for a book that's too large. We left out 4 or 5, I'm sure, so, you know, that's a body of work.
We did, because we didn't like those ones. But
their endings were too complete, so they couldn't go in.
I just felt that you should cherry pick, you know. I just think that, you know, we should have at least acted like we were cherry picking.
Yeah.
But we were cherry picking because we did sit down and we did go through your body of work. And what was interesting was that some of your earliest works stood up against your current, you know, writing output. And I thought that was That's interesting. And I wonder if that comes back to your not churning out 30 short stories a year.
Well, I guess, certainly at this point in my writing career, to use that word.
Yes.
I find that if I'm not doing writing that actually means something to me, I just can't sustain it. Like the idea of sitting down and just, you know, writing four stories randomly between now and the end of the year for no particular reason that didn't have any particular sort of thing to say to me, just feels a little pointless because, you know, I've got a day job, so I've already got pointless going on. I don't really need it in my writing. So I just feel that, you know, it sounds sort of old-fashioned or something, but...
No, I don't think...
Well, the stories that mean something to me personally, I don't really see a point in putting them in the world.
Mm.
Yeah. But you never know, maybe I'll sell out any day now and turn into a hack writer.
Yes. Yeah, that won't be awesome. So, yeah. So that means that... How do you see your... I described how I see your body of work, but then how do you see what you're writing if everything you want to write means something to you? Do you see, you know, that you have some kind of message that you would like to impart on the world? I tried to say that with a straight face.
Do I have a message? Oh,
What is it that you want to say? Why do your stories mean stuff to you?
I know when I started, it was really important to me that I was attempting to express something to the world. And, you know, so there was this idea of me and then the world as this sort of wall in front of me and I was going to put my mark on it. That was definitely something that motivated me early on. In the last few years, I've actually become more interested in sort of having a conversation with the world rather than just sort of shouting at it. I don't know if that's coming across at all, but the idea of just expressing myself to a passive recipient audience isn't as interesting to me. You know, the idea of actually engaging with an audience has become really interesting, which is why it's good when you get the good editing, where people can say to you, well, this bit's not working, and you know, there's sort of an absence of something here, because you're actually engaging with an editor at that point who will help you shape a work into something that appeals to an audience, and that's something that, you know, you miss out on a lot of the time because editors, being as busy as they are, will often prefer to reject a story than work on it. So, you know, the best thing I find that can happen for a writer is having an editor take you seriously and try to achieve what you're setting out to achieve in the first place. Rather than, you know, awards and publications and all of that stuff, actually having an editor engage with you is definitely the best part of writing.
Yeah. As an editor, that's actually the most fun because it does very much feel that way. I think when you have a synergy with a writer and it's a back and forth, that is pretty cool. But it's not about me. It's about you. You tend to be awarded in the horror section of Australian speculative fiction. Do you see yourself as a horror writer? You're a very dark, often pessimistic outcomes, maybe, not necessarily stories. Do you relate to yourself as a horror writer?
I don't tend to think of myself as a horror writer, but when people ask me, you know, people who aren't particularly readers find out that I write and they say, oh, what do you write? I tend to say horror to them because I think it's the most sort of widely understood label for the kind of sensation you'll end up with if you read my stuff. But I don't think of myself as a horror writer particularly. But I think the reason I end up in that camp a lot is because horror is often quite visceral. I mean, horror is generally aimed at some kind of, you know, physical response or, you know, a sense of dread or, you know, something like that, awakening in your gut. That's the kind of sensation you get out of good horror. And that's sort of the kind of sensation I like to induce in an audience as well. Bless them, poor little things. So I think that's why I end up in horror. Not so much because I think, you know, what I'm writing is necessarily horror, but that it has the same effect as you know, good horror does have, which is very flattering. I mean, I think it's great. I've gotten a lot of support from horror readers and writers in Australia, so I'm chuffed to bits about it. But, yeah, I find it weird to label myself as a particular writer in any sort of genre. I mean, I'm definitely not a science fiction writer, But I also don't think of myself as a fantasy writer either. So, you know, it's
too realistic.
Mm.
Which is where the horror comes in.
Yeah, exactly. And that's probably one of the other synergies I have with horror is that it does tend to start with that wonderful, realistic sort of kitchen sink kind of setup. Here we all are at the dining table having pizza, isn't it fun? And, oh, by the way, something horrific's happening outside that window that didn't exist in that wall until 2 minutes ago. That's kind of freaky.
Yeah. Okay, so, but you are working on a novel. So, do you, I mean, because you can't make a living on short stories. Is the novel the ultimate holy grail for writing?
Oh, good question, because if you say it's not, then what is, you know, is the trilogy or is the ongoing series the holy grail? I mean, I went into the novel originally because I felt like I should. You know, mm-hmm. it felt like something you just had to do if you were going to be considered a serious writer. Then, you know, you had to do a novel, and so there was very much a sort of a sense of duty when I started. But what I've discovered as I work through this damn thing is, you know, I mentioned earlier that I love the intellectual challenge. Well, bloody hell, a novel is certainly far more challenging than a short story is. In terms of the logistics and the, you know, just the actual sort of sitting down. How do you sit down for that long to write a novel? You know, everything from the ground up was a new learning curve for me in novel writing. And particularly, you know, trying to sustain a narrative or subplots or any of that stuff across an extended number of words has been, you know, a huge challenge. So I wouldn't say it's the holy grail. But certainly if you've been writing short stories and you want to learn something new, then it's a great thing to attempt.
I like that. So can I ask you what your novel's about?
Oh, you can try. I used to have a really good pitch lined up, but then I went and threw the whole thing away and started again.
Hmm.
So I don't have quite as clear a pitch, but roughly it's about a woman's journey into the dangers of the subconscious in search of her dead husband.
Right.
Yeah, it's uplifting.
Yeah, well, it's a Biancotti.
Yeah.
which is about the point where I talk about the fact that you're a 12th planet author.
Yes.
And we are hoping to have your collection out later this year.
Rah.
Definitely a question people are interested in is what, how you approached your collection. And I guess what you're hoping the product will achieve.
Well, some of the stories, at least the first two, and then a draft of the third, they actually already existed before the 12th Planet project came along. Mm-hmm. So I'm writing a set of five related stories, so a story suite, basically, set in the one world, examining the one theme, but from the point of view of five different characters. And it sort of happened itself, irregardless of the actual project. And the idea was that there would be, you know, someone that turns up in chapter one who is less important in the following chapters, but is still around. So what do I hope to achieve? You know, I just really like the intermediate lengths for stories at the moment. So I've also got a novella coming out, for example, at 20,000 words. And the Toth Planet book will be about 30,000, I think.
Yeah.
And I just like that idea of holding someone in a story for that length of words. Even if in the Toth Planet situation it's actually a series of stories, overall there is a kind of an attempt at a grander narrative.
Well, it's called Bad Power. We can have that scoop for this little interview here. I've read 4/5 of it this week in the new version, so I can't comment on how it ends, which is the best way to read your work. And I was very much struck by that. Not that it's like, you know, I'm patting you on the back whilst we're having this chat now. That they are, I was fascinated by how they are short stories that are not necessarily, that one doesn't pick up where the other one left off, yet it still feels like I'm reading a novel.
Hmm. Okay, that's good. Well, that's a good outcome.
So that's a tick there.
Excellent.
Yes. So beyond your 12 Planet collection and your short story coming out in Gilgamesh, is that right? Your novella.
Yes, my novella, yep.
What else can we expect to hear from Deb Biancotti, or will we just have to wait and see?
Well, I'm finishing the novel this year as well.
Cool.
Doesn't mean that actually come out anywhere anytime soon. Lord knows what will happen to the little thing, actually. But I have plans on at least two other novels which are completely unrelated. So that's kind of chewing up my excitement levels at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of other short stories, but when I sort of am struck by the mood to write short stories or I have an idea, I'll jot them down. But I'm not spending as much effort on them at the moment. So there's a few more that exist. And maybe one day they'll be published somewhere. But, I can't make those sort of promises, really. I just write them. Other people publish them or not. Mostly other people don't publish them. That's how they go.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me, Elisa, and all your audience.
Oh, good night.
Adios.